evening. I want to welcome everybody to ExamPro's free teleseminar for August 24th, 2025. We will get going here in just a few minutes, but I just want to explain what this is about, just for anybody who's new. But essentially what we do is we do this free teleseminar every other week. It's a chance for people to submit questions, and then we will discuss those questions and give advice. So I have several questions that have been submitted for tonight, and I'll call on the individuals if they are present, and we can talk a little bit about the scenarios that they bring up. I will ask any of you who are not actively discussing one of the discussants in the hot seat, I'll ask if you will please mute your volume on your device, just so that we won't have background noise. And I'm going to go ahead and get started. I'm going to first ask if we have Zoe on the call. We're going to start with Zoe if she is on the call.
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, great. So Zoe, I know that you submitted a question, and usually the way that works best is I'd like to have you just, if you can, not necessarily tell everything about the scenario, but kind of give a brief synopsis and the question that you submitted.
Sure. This is the case of a 39-year-old woman. She's a G9P6, and she has a diagnosis of pregnancy of unknown location and was breastfeeding. Basically, the question, in running through the case, there were several points where the patient did not follow medical advice, and ultimately she received methotrexate while she was breastfeeding, which is one of the contraindications. So I thought it would be an interesting case to discuss.
Okay, so let me just make sure I understand, just to fill in a few details here. So the patient was breastfeeding and then underwent an evaluation for a new pregnancy, and you said pregnancy of unknown location was the diagnosis. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. So what was the reason that the patient was given the methotrexate?
Yeah. So the patient with pregnancy of unknown location underwent a DNC in the office, and pathology showed secretory endometrium. So this made me more convinced that she had an ectopic pregnancy and not either an early gestation that just couldn't be detected on ultrasound, or like a failed IUP. The patient was admitted for post-procedure pain control and was recommended to go to the operating room for uncontrolled pain, but she declined. She declined going to surgery basically under any circumstance.
Okay. Now, who gave her the methotrexate?
I did. So I kept her overnight. I gave her pain medications. I performed serial abdominal exams and vital checks. Ultimately, she was stable and her pain improved. And so I didn't continue to push for her to go to the operating room. And ultimately, she wanted treatment for her ectopic pregnancy and was willing to accept the risk that the methotrexate could interfere with her breastfeeding and be passed on to her baby through the breast milk. And then ultimately, she had a successful course. She underwent serial beta HCGs and the pregnancy result.
Okay, great. So I have some ideas about a few things I want to mention to you, but before I do that, I just want to ask, what was your greatest concern about this scenario?
There's a big box in the practice bulletin that says that concurrent breastfeeding is a contraindication to methotrexate administration for for ectopic pregnancy. And so I just kind of wanted to run through that.
Okay, perfect. So I figured that that was probably the biggest concern. And before we get to that, let me just mention a couple of other things about this case that I think are important. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Okay, good. So the first thing was, it sounded like the diagnosis was established in a very appropriate way, where the patient had several potential data points over time leading to an evacuation of the endometrium, which was negative for a pregnancy, correct?
Correct.
Okay, good. So I like that part, because sometimes with these type of cases, one of the issues can be whether the evaluation of the endometrial cavity was performed prior to giving methotrexate, which is recommended by ACOG. I think two concerns about the case that relate to the treatment would be the patient you mentioned was somewhat unreliable or non-compliant. Did you tell me that?
Yeah. Well, she wasn't, so this is following, she wasn't following our medical advice to go for surgery due to the concern she had acute pain after her DNC. But she was well known to the clinic and had been there many times before. So in terms of following up for lab tests for serial data.
Yeah, you see my point. Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So
that's the key thing with that point, is that I would want to make sure that while she might not be agreeing with the advice that was given, there wasn't any concern about her not performing follow-up if she agreed to do it.
Yeah. Okay. So mentioning that sooner rather than later would be good. Okay.
Well, so instead of saying that she was non-compliant, or the way you described it initially made me concerned that she might not be a good candidate for methotrexate because she might not do the recommended follow-up. But that was really my concern with that, where now what I'm hearing is that she just wasn't willing to undergo the recommended, the preferred treatment.
Right.
And that's a little bit different sort of situation. And so the key thing is you want to make sure that you're not describing a non-compliant, poorly reliable patient and then giving them methotrexate, which absolutely requires follow-up. Okay?
Okay.
Second thing is, when I heard you talk about the acute pain that she had, the concern in my mind was, could this be a sign of a ruptured ectopic, in which case, again, methotrexate would not be appropriate. But what I'm hearing is that the pain was related to her uterine procedure, and that it sounds like she did not have an acute abdomen.
Correct.
Okay, perfect. So then that brings us to the decision about methotrexate. It was clear that you recommended surgery. I believe that was how you were presenting this, correct?
Yes, that's right.
Okay, good. And we will have situations in which the preferred treatment, and I would say that in this case, surgery would be preferable over methotrexate if the patient's not willing to stop breastfeeding. I think we will have situations where patients will receive counseling about the risks and benefits. What did you tell her about the risks of methotrexate if she's breastfeeding?
Here's the other reason to bring this up. I looked up lactational medicine resources, and I couldn't find any evidence that a baby has ever been harmed by administering methotrexate to their breastfeeding mother. but this is scenarios where I don't want to, like, challenge the expert. I don't want to make it seem like I think I know more than the examiner. So my honest answer is, I looked it up in my lactational medicine resources, and I really couldn't find evidence of any significant harms. And based on, like, laboratory studies that were performed, there were very low levels of methotrexate found in the breast milk, even days or weeks after administration. So that's what I told the patient, and she felt that best for her to continue breastfeeding despite having received methotrexate.
Okay, before I comment on that, let me ask you this. What did you tell her regarding breastfeeding right around the time of the methotrexate administrations?
That she should pump while she was in the hospital because she was separated from her baby. So we just dumped the milk that was collected while she was in the hospital.
And so if you were in a situation where she might be as an outpatient, how long would you tell her to dump it for?
Ooh, 24 hours. The answer is I don't know. I have to stop.
Okay, did she receive a single dose therapy?
She did receive a single dose therapy.
Okay, good. So here's kind of my response to what you're saying. I agree with you. There's not a lot of good data on methotrexate during breastfeeding. What we do know is it appears that the amount of methotrexate that goes into the breast milk is very low, maybe 1% or so of the dose that the mother receives. So a single dose of methotrexate like is given for an ectopic pregnancy probably represents a minimal risk for breastfeeding. And if a patient if this is the treatment that has been elected, then probably the best approach is to pump and dump. In fact, if the patient knows in advance, they could pump and save milk prior to treatment. Use that milk during the 24 hours around the immediate dose, and then pump and dump for 24 hours as a way of trying to minimize exposure during what potentially would be the highest level of medication exposure, okay? If a patient receives a multiple dose regimen, then that pump and dump period would likely need to be expanded, okay? And I think that this is what I would call a controversial topic, but in a good kind of way, because it represents some difficult issues that there are not data-driven, clear-cut answers for, okay? However, the evidence that is available does suggest, like you said, that the risk should be relatively low. And so I actually think that the way I would handle this is I would definitely acknowledge to the examiners that the concern is the potential risk of methotrexate, although the likelihood of harm should be low because the transmission of methotrexate into the breast milk is going to be low. And you recommended pumping and dumping around the time of the methotrexate administration. They'll probably ask you how long you recommended that for. And that this obviously would not have been your first choice treatment. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think that's the discussion that will give you the best defense in the oral exam, because you made it clear that this was not your preferred first choice treatment. But I think it is reasonable, and I think when you look up references on this topic, you find this kind of approach is utilized, although, you know, again, we're not completely sure how much risk there is. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, that's really helpful. That's a very, diplomatic way of saying it. Thank you.
Yeah, and if they push you, you know, remember at the end of the day, you did the research that you could do. So you can mention, well, I tried to do as much research as I could on this, and what I found was that there should be low levels and that there's not a lot of data on known risks, even though I would have preferred that we did a different treatment. Okay?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I like that.
Okay, great.
I would have first choice treatment, or I would have preferred different treatment. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, which I think you made clear, and I think that's going to work. So any other questions for me regarding this?
I think that's it. Thank you.
Okay, great. I'm going to move on to our next person. Avis, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, Avis, so I'm going to ask you to do the same thing. If you could briefly present to me the question that you submitted, just so that everybody listening knows what we're going to talk about.
Yeah, so I have two cases in my case list, and then the first one actually in the GYN list, the other in the office list, but both of them actually have a chronic pelvic pain. And one I did a diagnostic lab without peritoneal biopsy. The other one I actually did the diagnostic lab together with the biopsy because of the positive findings during the laparoscopy. And my question is, okay, is there any guidelines or consensus that we have to do a peritoneal biopsy during the diagnostic laparoscopy for chronic pelvic pain? This is the first. The second question is, for the other one, I didn't get the peritoneal biopsy. She actually have some bowel adhesions to the abdominal wall. And at that time, I didn't feel like her chronic pelvic pain is related with the adhesions. And I'm definitely not like an expertise in doing the adhesiolysis at that time. So I just leave it as this. But thinking back, should I consult a general surgeon at that time and ask him to do the adhesiolysis? So those are the two questions, and which I'm worried that the examiners might actually ask me during the examination.
Excellent questions. Okay, so let me ask you, when you do a diagnostic laparoscopy and you see endometriosis on the peritoneum, are you asking if you should routinely biopsy visible lesions, or are you asking if you don't see lesions, should you do random biopsies?
Yes, this is a later question. So for my okay, in my practice, right. I used to biopsy all the visible lesions, but I don't see any visualized lesions. I just leave it as is. But the second patient that I didn't see it, she actually had some bowel adhesions, and I didn't get any biopsy, and also didn't ask the general surgeon to come in to do the lysis of adhesions.
Now, you mentioned that you did not think that the adhesions would be related to her pain. Is that because of the characteristics of her pain? Is that why you were saying that?
Yes, that's correct. So her pain is more in the pelvic area, and the adhesions is actually in the cecum to the anterior abdominal wall. So, and just based on the pre-op examinations and the description of the pain before the surgery, and I didn't see the correlations with the adhesion. And then second is, I believed adhesiolysis is not very helpful, like in a mild to moderate degree of adhesion. And so at that time, I feel like, okay, even the general surgeon come over to analyze the adhesion might not do any benefits to the patient.
Okay, good. I actually think that you have somewhat answered your own questions, and I like your answers, but let me just review so that everybody is clear. First of all, I do think if you see a lesion that looks like endometriosis in a laparoscopy that was done for pelvic pain, that the best practice is to biopsy the lesion so that you have histologic confirmation, because visual diagnosis of endometriosis is not as reliable as people sometimes think it is. And this is important for the long-term treatment of the patient so that other physicians later will have the proof from the histology that endometriosis was actually present. So if you see a lesion, biopsy would be recommended. Now, the idea of no visible lesions, should you do random peritoneal biopsies, that is not routinely recommended. There are some people who do this, but it is not routinely recommended, and I would not expect you to do that. And the last question about the adhesions. So you are correct that lysis of adhesions as a treatment for chronic pelvic pain has not been shown to be particularly useful, especially if the adhesions don't relate to a process that you attribute to causing her pain. So let me mention what I mean by that. If you presume a patient has endometriosis and you do a laparoscopy and you see evidence of endometriosis and you see some adhesions that are part of the endometriosis disease process, then lysing those adhesions potentially might be a reasonable thing to do. But like in your case where you're describing adhesions that were remote from the location of the patient's pain that did not appear to be associated with endometriosis or some other disease process that you had been expecting, then lysis of adhesions is unlikely, based upon the evidence that's out there, to make a big difference. The question about whether to consult, I do think that if it depends on kind of the findings, if you have distorted anatomy because of adhesions, it's never a problem to consult general surgery if we're talking about bowel adhesions. The fact that you didn't, I don't think is necessarily an issue either. But if you had consulted general surgery, I don't think that would have been a wrong move either. You had to make an assessment at that time as to whether it looked like something that could be significant. And your opinion, based on the patient's symptoms, preoperative evaluation, and intraoperative findings, was that this did not look like something that was a concern. And I think it's a completely reasonable approach. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, I just want to see, like, what's the general consensus from, like, the other parts of the... Because I'm basically working in my own institution, so I only know our local guidelines. So I just want to make sure that
I like your management. Random biopsies, I would not recommend lysis of adhesions if it does not appear to be related to the patient's symptoms. Again, I think that has been of limited benefit in the studies on that. So I agree with you.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. All right, I am going to ask if we have Sarah on the line.
Yes, I'm here.
Sarah, would you mind telling me a little bit about the question that you sent in?
Yes, so my patient is a 44-year-old para 1 with abnormal uterine bleeding. 3 years prior, this patient had an endometrial biopsy by another practice that showed simple hyperplasia without atypia. This patient declined all hormonal medications and also declined a hysterectomy, and she very much wanted an endometrial ablation. And so upon repeat sampling, she was found to only have proliferative endometrium. The patient had undergone a significant weight loss over the past 3 years. So then after a consultation with GYN oncology, we did end up doing an endometrial ablation. So my question was, you know, even if a patient did have this history, which is traditionally not, you know, first-line therapy and almost near a contraindication, you know, could that ever outweigh the risks?
Yeah, I would actually argue that endometrial ablation, the way it's described, is contraindicated in patients with a history of hyperplasia. And usually when you read that, they don't differentiate hyperplasia that's simple versus complex or with or without atypia, that it's just hyperplasia in general. Can I ask you a question before I answer your question?
Yes.
Why is endometrial ablation generally considered a contraindication in patients with hyperplasia?
Because they do have a risk for endometrial cancer, and you'd be basically occluding the endometrium, making it harder to diagnose anything later.
That is half the answer. And do you know what the other half is?
There's a risk of occult cancer
potentially spread.
I'm sorry, I'm not sure who else was talking, but Sarah, go ahead. What were you going to say?
I was going to say, is there a risk that cancer could spread with the ablation?
Actually, I don't have any data on that, but the concern is that endometrial ablation does not lower the risk of developing endometrial cancer. So a hysterectomy obviously would lower that risk, okay? So when you have a procedure where you have a patient with potentially having hyperplasia in the past would be a risk factor for hyperplasia in the future, and which could lead to endometrial cancer. So when you have a patient with that kind of a history, then if you do the ablation, you may mask symptoms, you may delay diagnosis or make diagnosis more difficult, but you're not actually, by doing the ablation, you're not actually lowering the risk of endometrial cancer. Does that make sense?
It does.
Now, you mentioned something in your presentation that was interesting, which is that he had weight loss, significant weight loss prior to the procedure. And that brings up a separate issue, which I'll mention, which is abnormal uterine bleeding in patients with risk factors for endometrial cancer, which could be obesity or PCOS. These are potentially relative contraindications to endometrial ablation. So I think personally, I would, in this case, recommend against ablation, but I think that's what you did, right?
I strongly recommended her against having an ablation. This patient had, you know, very negative side effects with hormonal therapy in the past. She was not willing to take any type of progesterone. She had also had a history of multiple abdominal surgeries and knew that she would be at high risk for any kind of complication with a hysterectomy. So she was completely set on an ablation, which is why I spoke to GYN oncology, because this would not be my preferred therapy for this patient. But, you know, we did thorough counseling. We did shared decision making. And ultimately, that's what this patient chose to do.
And the thing I like the most about your presentation is the way you handled it, because you had concerns about this treatment in this patient. You counseled the patient, you know, because they were significant concerns. This was not just a case of shared decision making. This was a case of your recommendation was against what the patient was asking for. And you had good reasons for that. And you explained those to the patient, and the patient still was unrelenting. So you did what anybody should do. You consulted an expert regarding the particular concerns you had, which in this case would be GYN oncology. And GYN oncology, in reviewing the situation, you know, felt like this was a reasonable thing to do, correct?
I did.
And that's exactly how I would present it. I would present it as I had concerns, you know, what your concerns were. You counseled the patient against this treatment. The patient was adamant. And then you consulted GYN oncology for a second opinion. And after a review of the patient's situation, the decision was made that this was reasonable, albeit not the usual approach. Okay. Now, I think that there's still going to potentially be the possibility in the oral exam that examiners are not going to like it. Okay.
Agree. I don't like
and
it
I think
either.
You have to. Yes, I think you have to recognize that. And this is where knowing the case really well, so knowing that you were mentioning the patient's history, and there's a number of factors going on here that are, you know, potentially leaning in favor of one thing versus another. It's not a simple decision, okay? So I think knowing the patient's history, knowing the potential risks and benefits of the different options, getting the second opinion from GYN oncology, this was not your preferred approach. I think these are all the things that you use to defend this case. And remember, at the end of the day, in the oral exam, they're not going to look across the table and go, okay, that's good. We get it. They're going to challenge you. They may leave you feeling like they think that you did something wrong, but that's how the exam works. They don't show you their cards, okay? If you present it the way that you described, I think that they will understand. Does that make sense?
It does. And I guess my, you know, the follow-up question to that is, you know, this patient had this history of simple hyperplasia without atypia 3 years prior. I've sampled her twice before this procedure, and both times it was proliferative endometrium. Now, because she you know, modified her major risk factor of being obese, does that in any way still decrease her future risk because she already had a history of the simple hyperplasia?
I don't think anybody knows. But the one question I would ask you is, you sampled her twice. How did you sample her?
I did it with hysteroscopy DNC both times.
Ah, nice. Now that is a good answer. I was wondering what you were going to tell me there. Why is that a good answer?
Because if she had lesion, because if, you know, anybody who, especially someone with EIN, you want to make sure you're visualizing the entire endometrium, you could find an occult lesion that an office pipel might miss if you're doing that blindly.
Absolutely. So be prepared to describe a very thorough approach to going into the uterine cavity, identifying the tubal ostea and the fundus, and in a very systematic way, examining the entire endometrial cavity, looking for any focal lesions. And of course, if there were any focal lesions, you would do a directed biopsy. So I think it's when I listen to this case, it sounds like you pretty much did just about everything you could except for denying to treat the patient. You know, which we sometimes have to compromise on treatment decisions when the patient has been well counseled. And having a second opinion from GYN oncology is part of that well counseling. Okay?
Okay.
So I think you're doing the right thing in the way that you're concerned about this case. And I think that you should present it as you did, because that, I think that is going to be the best defense. Okay?
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. All right. I'm going to next ask if we have Nishita on the call.
Yes. Hi, I'm here.
Hi. Would you mind presenting the case that you sent in?
Absolutely. So this is a 38-year-old G3P2 who came into the emergency room at 5 weeks pregnant by LMP with vaginal spotting. On evaluation, she had very scant bleeding, but she had an ultrasound finding of a gestational sac that was asymmetric with a mean sac diameter of 0.66 centimeters and a possible yolk sac with a read that was concerning for a corneal ectopic pregnancy. I have two questions. My first question is that I've already submitted my case list. Obviously, it's August 24th, and in my diagnostics procedure, I didn't write down her beta HCG. But I know it because I've reviewed the case, but that's an error in the way that I documented it. But her beta HCG was 68, so it was obviously very well below the discriminatory zone. And so I ended up counseling this patient on all of her options. It was a desired pregnancy. And so the way that I counseled her was that she had mainly, you know, three options. The first would be expectant management with serial beta HCG to check for the trend to see whether or not it was appropriately rising. And then with the concern of a corneal ectopic or an interstitial pregnancy, she's at a much higher risk of morbidity, mortality in the setting of catastrophic like hemorrhage if it were to rupture, and then also surgical management. But I personally have never done a wedge resection, nor would I have felt comfortable doing a wedge resection on my own. And so the main two treatment options that I offered her were methotrexate versus serial monitoring expectant management. The reason that I'm a bit worried about this case is because she ended up opting for methotrexate, but I think part of that was because the counseling that I did very much so emphasize that this is not just a typical ectopic pregnancy, but if there is true concern for corneal ectopic, that she is at an even higher risk than a normal ectopic pregnancy of a hemorrhagic emergency. But I think the argument could be that we only had one data point, one beta HCG, it was below the discriminatory zone. And if it was a desired pregnancy, how can we be absolutely sure that it's a corneal ectopic?
Yeah, that's a lot going on with that case. So I want to ask you, did the patient have any signs of a ruptured ectopic?
No. So she was completely hemodynamically stable. Her hemoglobin was stable. Her blood pressures were stable. She had no peritoneal signs on abdominal exam. Although she came in with vaginal spotting on our special exam, there's very scant bleeding, if any.
Okay. So what about the considerations? Because I want to make sure I understood this. Were you favoring getting a second data point, or were you favoring treating her at that episode of care?
So I was favoring treating her at that episode of care only because I had only managed maybe two true corneal ectopic pregnancies, and both of them in my residency, we had admitted them, and one of them had even gotten intra-sac methotrexate just because, you know, corneal ectopics rupturing are much more of a hemorrhage risk than just a regular ectopic rupture. And then I also actually, I did get a second opinion, but it wasn't necessarily like a second opinion in the hospital. I called one of my mentors who was managing our beta book, and I went through the scenario with her, and she basically said that both of these options are reasonable. You could offer methotrexate. You know, you have a patient who has a positive beta HCG, you have an ultrasound that's telling you concern for corneal ectopic pregnancy, but you could also offer her expectant management with close return precautions, which is how I counseled her. But I will say that I emphasize that if this is truly a corneal ectopic pregnancy, that it is high risk.
Yeah, I think there's a couple things that make this case difficult. First is that what you described to me was that there was no fetus visualized, correct?
Correct.
Okay, and the gestational sac was irregular, relatively small, and the HCG was very low.
Correct.
Okay, so I think that there is a reasonable consideration in a stable patient for at least one follow-up data point, essentially 48 hours, to trend what the HCG is doing, because there is the possibility that the HCG could actually be going down, okay? And that this patient could be in the process of a spontaneous pregnancy loss. So I think that's it's a reasonable option, but the concern, of course, is how reliable is your imaging, because interstitial pregnancy or corneal ectopics are notoriously difficult to diagnose, although we're getting better and we're doing it earlier. So that would be the real dilemma in this case, is whether to get at least one more data point just for the purpose of ruling out a spontaneous pregnancy loss already underway. Does that make sense?
Correct.
Okay.
Now,
Yep. Ultimately, after talking to her about it and talking to her about the risks of it, she and her husband were like, I don't want to risk something that could impact me. Like, although it was desired, like, we'd rather go for the methotrexate than the serial beta HCG. And so
absolutely,
I felt like, you know, with the counseling that I did, you know, telling her that she had these options, that I feel like they were both reasonable. In hindsight, when I'm reflecting on the case, I think maybe I would have, I don't want to say sway, but maybe have counseled her a little bit more strongly for the repeat beta HCG. But I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that both would be reasonable options for management. Because the other thing that, as I'm a urogyn fellow, but this was during one of my call shifts, so it was as the role of an attending.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, as a newer attending, I am always thinking, like, on paper, right, if I have a patient and the ultrasound says the word suspected corneal ectopic and I were to not offer her appropriate management for a corneal ectopic, like, I think that would be also a really big red flag.
Oh, actually, and I don't want to be misinterpreted. Okay. I was not proposing that you would recommend treatment as the only option. I was simply mentioning that expectant management for additional data points would be potentially reasonable. I was not advocating that you should have done that, but I do think that the issue with this is that you have three options and they're all difficult. First would be expectant management with the concern if it is a corneal ectopic and you have a rupture, obviously, as you described, the risks being significant. Second would be methotrexate and how to administer methotrexate in this scenario, because that was going to be my next question, so I'll get right back to that. Third is surgical management. Now, surgical management has gotten a lot better, and there are a lot of people that aren't going to do a wedge resection anymore. Instead, they'll do a corneostomy and just open the cornea and remove the pregnancy. So, again, you're not having experience with it. You wouldn't want to experiment on a patient. You'd want to refer this patient to a surgeon that had experience. But there's also the opportunity to do laparoscopic wedge resection if that were necessary versus open. There's multiple options. But I want to get back to the methotrexate for a second. What methotrexate regimen did you treat her with?
I just did a single-dose methotrexate injection and then added her to our, like, beta book for day 4, day 7 at repeat labs, and then her beta HCG did come down to 0. But to answer your question, could it have just been that she was already miscarrying, or did the methotrexate
possible
corneal pregnancy?
So the issue about the methotrexate, it's certainly possible that she could have been miscarrying. It's also possible that the methotrexate was the solution. I think the issue about methotrexate is that it is described with corneal or interstitial pregnancies more commonly being done with a multiple dose protocol. Now, this is a very early pregnancy with a very low HCG. So I think it is not necessarily unreasonable to do it the way you did it. But I do think that if you look into this and read a little bit about this, you may have already found that it is often described with a multiple dose protocol.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I have two follow-up questions. Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
So
all I was going to say is that I do think it's important to know the different methotrexate protocols. If you didn't have this case, I wouldn't feel as strongly about it. But I think you should be able to describe the different protocols, the single dose, two dose, and multi-dose with leucovorin and rescue. I think you should just know those well enough in the exam that they don't trip you up on just asking you to describe the regimens that are possible. Okay?
Okay, perfect. That's super helpful. Thank you. My other question was going to be, one, I talked to a co-fellow who passed boards last year, and she said, just tell them that it was undesired. Because she's like, if you tell them it was undesired, then it doesn't beg the question of the serial beta HCGs and seeing if it was in fact going to be a normal IUP. But that's not what actually happened in real life. And then on that same note, she's like, since you didn't write the beta HCG under diagnostic procedures, why don't you just say that the beta HCG was above the discriminatory zone? Which is also not what actually happened in real life. So I'm wondering what advice you have on that.
I have good advice on both of those things. First, let me start by saying that I do not recommend making things up in the exam because do you have children?
I don't, but I'm actually expecting. So.
Okay, all right. So when they get a little bit older, they will sometimes start to make up stories. And what you will figure out is that it's really hard to get all the pieces to line up so that the story actually makes sense when you get into the details. And so eventually, if you start to tell stories, if you lie in the exam, you usually get caught. And then what's the conclusion of the examiner's going to be? Pass or fail?
Fail.
Yeah, absolutely. So don't lie in the exam because it's not going to help you. But the good news is, you did not document the HCG on the case list, and you asked in the beginning whether that was a problem. Not a problem at all. You know the HCG, so you can present the HCG verbally. That's perfectly fine. And then let's get to the desired versus undesired. So I don't want to confuse this situation with a pregnancy of unknown location, because this situation, the way you described it, is not a pregnancy of unknown location. It is a presumed corneal ectopic. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
You have enough evidence that there is some concern that's been documented on imaging. And so with that in mind, the desired versus undesired is not really so relevant in that you counsel the patient regarding the options. One of the options would be to observe for a subsequent data point. But given that this is a possible corneal ectopic, the risks associated with that are a little greater than in a situation where we don't have any information, okay? Because knowing it could be a corneal ectopic means slightly greater risk, and the patient made an informed decision not to proceed that way. So at that point, it is essentially an undesired pregnancy because the patient preferred not to take the risk. Does that make sense?
Absolutely.
And
I
want to make clear, we're not advocating for expectant management of a corneal ectopic. We are simply advocating that one option for a motivated patient would be to get another data point to determine whether the HCG is going up or down since she was stable, and potentially follow-up imaging to help solidify the diagnosis. But those are options, not required. And so I don't think you did anything wrong. I think the biggest issue will be the decision about the methotrexate regimen and just being prepared to talk about the different options that are available. And, you know, because it was such an early pregnancy with a low HCG, I think you're more likely to be successful with a single dose. But I would know all the regimens. Make sense?
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Okay. Any other questions?
Not about that one. So I appreciate it.
Okay, great. All right, so with that said, we have had our case presentations tonight. I want to thank Zoe, Avis, Sarah, and Nishita for bringing those case presentations to us, really relevant and high-yield cases for the exam. And at this point, I'm going to go ahead and wrap this teleseminar up for tonight. I want to thank everybody for joining in and listening in. And there will be another teleseminar next Sunday. That's the 31st of August. We usually do them every other week, but this week we're a little bit off schedule. So there will be the next teleseminar August 31st at 5 p.m. Eastern Time. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Good night.